This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the years leading up to the Civil War, the federal government passed the Fugitive Slave Act. The law required authorities in northern and southern states alike to round up African Americans who had escaped slavery and return them to their owners. It was an attempt to quell the rising tensions between southern slave owners and northern anti-slavery movements. Instead, it ripped the country further apart and placed a bounty on people who had otherwise gained their freedom. This is the context in which North Carolina author Robert Morgan has written his latest novel. It's called Chasing the North Star, and it follows the dangerous journey of a teenage slave who has escaped into the Appalachian Mountains, hiding during the day and running at night with the North Star as his guide. Robert Morgan's going to be reading at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight at 7 o'clock, but first joins me on the State of Things. Welcome back, Robert Morgan. Good to talk with you.
Oh, good to be here.
This book was inspired, I understand, by true events that happened in your own family in western North Carolina. Tell us the story of Little Willie.
Well, the story came down to me from my dad, and he got it from his grandpa, Frank Pace. In the 1850s, my great-great-grandparents, Daniel Pace and Sarah Revis Pace and their son Frank, were sitting down to supper. One evening, I heard a noise out in the yard. Frank went to look, and he saw four people, two men, one woman, and a little boy. They were clearly escaping slaves from Georgia coming up into the mountains. They gave them water and something to eat, and the woman pushed the little boy to my great-great-grandmother and said, "Willie can't run no more." He had injured his foot or his leg. They kept the boy. The two men and women ran off into the dark. They were chased by bounty hunters. My great-great-grandmother hid little Willie in the meal bin behind the kitchen. And then she didn't know exactly what to do with him because it was a crime to help escape slaves. They hoped the family would come back for him. They didn't really know very much about him except his name was Willie. To protect him, they took him down to Greenville, South Carolina, hidden in a load of produce, things like hams, molasses, honey. They peddled their produce door to door, and then Little Willie rode on the wagon seat back, and they claimed they had bought him. That was the only way they could protect him. She made a blue jacket for Willie, which he was very proud of. They were out cutting timber on the spring hill a little bit later. Got hot. It was late winter. He took his jacket off. A tree was about to fall on it. Later, and he ran to get the jacket. His foot slipped on the thawing ground, and he was killed by the tree. As a kid, I was shown his grave in the family graveyard by my dad, the grave of Little Willie, and there was a blue mason jar there where my great-great-grandmother had brought flowers on the anniversary of his death. So I always wanted to do something with that story. It was so poignant, and it also reminded me that though slavery was not quite as big a thing in the mountains as it was in the Deep South, it was still there. It was present. Very few Appalachian writers have written about that. Typically, they write about, you know, the Scotch-Irish heritage and the music and that sort of thing. But for years, I have meant to write something about slavery in the Southern Appalachians, and this book is that. It's what I came up with.
Well, and you have written eloquently and quite a bit about the Appalachian region, and as you say, this is a book that deals with slavery. You've already done quite a bit of research about the region. Did you have to do much more now that you're sort of looking at this other aspect of life in Appalachia in the 19th century?
I did. I've spent so much of my life researching the history of the region, but I read some slave narratives, the famous ones and some that were not so famous, particularly Harriet Jacobs. And I also studied the region where I live in upstate New York because this story concludes up there. And I consulted local historians in the Finger Lakes area and any documents I could find about African Americans in Ithaca, New York. So I did some extra research. However, this is a work of fiction, so I mostly just made it up.
Well, maybe I could get you to read for us and, by doing so, introduce the characters, some of the main characters in this book. Would you do that for us?
I would. There are two main characters. There's Jonah Williams, and Angel Thomas. Jonah is about 18 years old, and he has grown up on a farm north of Greenville, South Carolina, just at the edge of the mountains. It's the kind of farm where they grow corn to sell to stock drovers who are coming down the Buncombe Pike. I'll read the opening. He was called Jonah because he was born during a terrible storm, and his mama said as soon as she let go of him and put him ashore in this world of folly and time, the thunder quieted and the wind laid. Trees had broken off their stumps and skipped across the fields like dust brooms, and the Saluda River spread wide over the bottomlands. Some of the slave cabins behind Mr. Williams' brick house got smashed to splinters by the high tempest. But soon as Jonah was cut loose and washed off in a pan and wrapped up in a towel rag, his mama said the sky cleared, and the moon came out and shined so bright you could see a needle in the light from the window. Everything the storm had ruined was vivid in the moonlight, including dead birds that had been torn from their roosts and snakes washed out of holes in the ground. Because Jonah arrived on the full of the moon in the middle of a storm under the sign of the crab, his mama called him her moon baby. The granny woman that delivered him said he'd always be darting away, running from one thing and then another. He'd be no more dependable than Jonah in the holy book.
That's Robert Morgan reading from his latest novel, Chasing the North Star. He's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight at 7, talking with me on the state of things right now. You know, it's interesting. You talked about where you are now in Cornell and Ithaca, New York, and that playing a part at the end of this story. But interestingly enough, when we think about upstate New York, of course, that's one of the places where the Underground Railroad was played such an important part. But the Underground Railroad is not a part in this escape adventure in Chasing the North Star. Tell us about that decision.
Well, Jonah doesn't know anybody connected to the Underground Railroad. He's isolated, but when he is whipped by his owner, ostensibly for stealing a book, he's learned to read because he listens to the tutor teaching the children of the owner, and he has learned to read, and he also has been found out. He's been caught by his mistress with a book, and she has him read the Bible to her secretly. She won't tell anybody that he's learned to read. He's not supposed to know how to read. But after he's humiliated, he's whipped for stealing a book to read by Mr. Williams, he decides he has to run off. And he has seen maps. He thinks that if he sticks to the Appalachian Mountains, he'll have a better chance hiding in the mountains and running at night, sleeping in the day. So he sets off up the mountain and near Asheville, North Carolina, encounters a jubilee, a party that the local slaves have secretly in the middle of the night. That's where he meets Angel. And when I discovered that character, Angel, I was very pleased. I knew that this was going to be important because I could alternate between Jonah's point of view and Angel's point of view.
Well, maybe I could ask you to read. Maybe I could ask you to read a passage from her perspective.
Yes, she tells her own story. Jonah's story is told in third person, but I alternate with her narration. Now, she has been caught disobeying her mother, who's gone off to Jubilee. This is her memory of the discovery of Jubilee, a big turning point in her life. She's a young woman. She says, the worst thing about a whipping was having to wait for it. Mama knew that, and I knew that, and I guess Master Thomas knew it too. For when he whipped one of his help from time to time, if they didn't mind. That was a bigger thing, though, an awful thing, to see a man whipped with a black snake whip till his back was cut and he was bleeding down to his feet. Mama might say as a warning, I'm going to cut the blood out of you, but she never did. She knew the worst part of punishment was the anticipation. The next morning, after we ate mush with molasses and I washed up the bowls, Mama said, "You know what I need? Go get me that hickory." It was a relief to finally go and get it over with. "Better be a good switch or I whip you twice," Mama said. Sad as it was to have to go after my own switch, there was a kind of dignity to it. All I had to do was get the hickory, bear the whipping, and cry a little to make Mama feel I was sorry, and then it would be all right again. I couldn't stand for Mama to be mad at me. If Mama was mad at me, then the whole world seemed twisted to the side and empty. After I brought her the switch, Mama made me go outside. I had to stand in the yard where everybody could see the whipping. She made me hold her left hand with my left hand, and she whipped me on my legs and on my butt. The hickory stung my skin like a hot wire. "How many times do I have to tell you to mind me?" Mama said as she swung the switch. "I do mind," I said. "Don't you sass me," Mama said and swung harder. I mind you," I said and started to cry. "You sass me, I cut the blood out of you," Mama said. She was so busy whipping me, and my eyes were so full of tears, neither of us saw the master standing nearby watching. The sleeves were rolled up like he was on the way to the field. When the crops needed tending, the master sometimes worked right alongside to help. "Don't whip that girl. She didn't mean to do nothing wrong," Master Thomas said. Mama stepped back and dropped a hickory to her side. "Angel's too pretty to whip," Master Thomas said. "Her skin's too perfect, and her face too pretty. What has she done?" "She don't mind me," Mama said. "She sassed me." The master put his hand on my shoulder and looked into my eyes. I shivered at his touch, yet I was pleased by it at the same time. I could feel the power in his hand, which was not the power of muscles and calluses. "Angel don't mean to be mad," Master Thomas said. "Besides, she's almost a young woman." He looked me in the eyes and smiled, and I tried to smile back through my tears. "Would you like to work in the big house?" the master said. "I think you've grown up enough to work in the big house. Would you like that?" I nodded, forgetting the sting on my legs. That was how I came to live in the master's house, before I was grown up. Mama didn't say anything. She washed me up, made me put on my clean dress. Other women in the quarters gave me looks, and Jessie May, who was a little older than me, said, "If master want to fiddle with you, you better let him." But I didn't answer her.
Robert Morgan, reading from his latest novel, Chasing the North Star. He's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight at 7 o'clock. Tell us about the decision to let Angel speak in the first person, speak in her own voice, whereas Jonah's story really is told from an omniscient point of view. When did that idea occur to you, and why did you do it?
It occurred to me when I imagined this character, Angel. I thought it was just a stroke of luck that I had. Most of my fiction in the past has been spoken in the voice of a woman character. And it somehow seemed right to write about Jonah in the third person, to put the story in a context. Because, see, third person has a much wider field of view, so to speak.
Yeah.
And first person is much narrower. And I thought alternating the two would work well.
Well, it leads me to wonder, as you said you discovered Angel, how far along were you in this kind of third-person narrative before Angel finally descended from the heavens for you?
I wrote a complete draft of the novel.
Wow.
Entirely about Jonah. And as I was revising it, it occurred to me that having another character would enrich it and just make the story deeper, I think, and more interesting. So that's when I thought of Angel, and I was awfully glad I did. But I can tell you this, that I first wrote the sections in Angel's voice in dialect and worked very hard with my editor, Shannon Ravenel, on that, and I thought we did a good job with it. Later, my other editor, Chuck Adams, questioned that because it was difficult to read. And I decided he was right, that we didn't want anything to interfere with the intimacy with Angel. We wanted the reader to feel he was right there with her voice in her mind. So I rewrote those sections in very plain grammatical English and explain later that she has learned to read and write, and so she would remember this in a much more grammatical voice. And I think it worked. I think it made it much more accessible to the reader. If you have too much dialect, it's just hard for modern readers, you know, in the 21st century to get it.
Well, particularly I think when you go back and forth, if it's all in dialect, pretty much you know at a certain point you get the rhythm, but if you keep kind of going in and out, it can make it more difficult, I suppose. Mm. I'm talking with Robert Morgan today on The State of Things. His new novel is Chasing the North Star. He's going to be at Flyleaf Books tonight at 7 o'clock. And the geographic setting for this is mostly the Appalachian Mountains. The time setting is important. This is placed just after the Fugitive Slave Law has been enacted, and that was deliberate on your part, too. Tell us about the time setting for this book.
Well, Jonah has learned to read, and he reads the newspapers, and he reads about the Fugitive Slave Law. And I wanted to place it at a time where he and Angel are in very great danger, perhaps more even than they know. Bounty hunters are out looking for escaped slaves, and even to kidnap people who are not escaped slaves. So it's a very dangerous time. I also wanted to write about what I call Northern Appalachia, where I've lived for many years, and to compare the culture of the different sections of the country. And the way people respond to Jonah and Angel changes as they go north. Of course, it's a route that's now Interstate 81, which I've traveled many times between my house in North Carolina and my house in upstate New York. But I wanted to make real to a modern reader the landscape, the cultural landscape, the linguistic landscape of that particular time.
You know, what's interesting is coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, the comparisons between our own times. When you talk about passing discriminatory laws like the Fugitive Slave Law, there were actually cities and localities that had their own sanctuary laws over and against the federal law. And of course, there was constant tensions. And we see that, you know, today right here in North Carolina, that same tension between people trying to protect rights and the kind of overarching larger government effort to deny them. I mean, I don't know that you had all that in mind. You couldn't have. But it's fascinating to see how these things continue to play out in the American landscape. I mean, I suppose it's one of the things that keeps a story like this alive. It's historical, and yet so many of the themes continue to play out in the American political landscape.
Oh, the issues of civil rights, I think, and freedom are permanent. I mean, it's always an issue. Of course, I think that the purpose of fiction, or one of the virtues of fiction, is that we can reach across time and create a sense of community. In a way, that's what fiction is about, is, you know, crossing barriers of gender, ethnicity, religion, race, even language through translation, and that connection with people who are superficially different from us, but have a common humanity is really one of the rewards of writing fiction and of reading it.
The other connection you make is in the forms of writing. You started out as a poet, and poetry, I feel, still informs your writing. It certainly is evident in your work. Do you feel the way that your experience in poetry informs your fiction writing?
Oh, certainly. My work in poetry over the years, I still work on poetry, as a matter of fact, but it certainly enable me to think of the textures of language and the cadences of language in a more vivid way. Writing poetry, you have to be concise, you have to be precise, economical. I worry about having exactly the right word, and I think I've used things I learned writing poetry in both my fiction and my nonfiction.
Robert Morgan, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Robert Morgan's new novel is called Chasing the North Star. It's going to be at Flyleaf Books tonight at 7 o'clock, and you can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. And there's more of The State of Things to come. Stay tuned.